We need one more member to officially have a quorum, so I think we will begin in the interest of time. So, Representative Anderson, you want to come down and we'll begin testimony on House File 2322, and we'll officially bring it before us as soon as we have one more member show up. It's difficult having a committee right after lunch. So I think we may have a formal policy next week. They can bring lunch if they have to. So, but welcome to the committee, and House File 2322, would like to explain your bill.
Sure, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I must have read your mind, and I did see that you guys were scheduled at 12:30, probably the worst time to have a committee considering the lunchtime situation. So in honor of Oreo and their 100th birthday, I did bring some treats for you all.
That'll teach those that aren't here.
Exactly. You snooze, you lose, right?
And I record, if you're not here, you don't get one.
That's right.
You get their share. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to present this legislation before you today. I was contacted by a constituent. He was supposed to be here, Brett Robb. I've never met him in person, so come on down, actually. This is the trouble with the issue of email being so readily available. You don't know faces anymore. So, but he had contacted me in August regarding his situation in being a student at the university and having health insurance. And I think what would probably be in the best interest of your time is to hear from him his own personal experience and the frustration that he has had in this issue. So if you could kind of tell your story, and then we'll
please,
wrap it up.
Please give us your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Yep, my name is Brett Raby. I'm a second career student in the veterinary school at the university. So leaving behind my career, of course, I left behind my health care options for myself and my family. I have three kids and a wife. The university, particularly the health school specifically, have a fairly restrictive requirement for wavering out of the university's health insurance.
Can I interrupt just for one moment? We have the prize goes to Representative Rukavina. Meeting is now officially called to order. And if we could quickly just do the minutes, we'll get that out of the way. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the minutes.
Okay, minutes from March the 1st. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Now, sorry for the little interruption, but we're now officially in business. So go ahead.
No problem. I'll start over. My name is Brett Raby. I'm a second career student at the university in the veterinary school. When I went into school, I discovered that the university, the health school, so this encompasses the medical school, the veterinary school, pharmacy school, school of nursing, so forth. They have a fairly restrictive requirement for health insurance. They offer waivers for very narrow categories, employer-sponsored health care, Minnesota care, one other category that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But association-sponsored health care is not meet their requirements. So for those of us that are in the health environment, the AMA, the AVMA, all offer health care programs to professional students. They're very comparable to the university's health care. They're quite a bit cheaper, to the tune of a $14,000 difference for me over the course of the next 4 years. And they also have the advantage of being portable. After we graduate, we can take that insurance with us wherever we practice. Unfortunately, the university does not. It does not because it's association care as opposed to employer-sponsored care. It doesn't meet the requirements. I met with the university a number of times to try and work this out, both via email and in person, and in the end it came down to their decision that the health schools had this policy in place and that was that, and they weren't interested in looking at making exemptions or looking at individual cases or anything like that. So my position is that the insurance offered by the AVMA, which is our Veterinary Professional Association, it's every bit as it's comparable to the university's insurance, and at a difference to me and my family of about $3,500 a year, it seems like a no-brainer to me, especially given the tuition increases over the last number of years and whatnot.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Rukavina?
Chair, maybe for Ms. Novak, does Minsky require have a similar requirement for health insurance for students? Does anybody know?
I don't think so. If there's somebody that can verify that.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's a requirement, but for Minsky.
Come on down. Please give us your name and then an answer.
Okay. My name is Keswick Joyner, Director of Risk Management for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Minsky does not have a mandatory plan, so our plan is voluntary. So students can opt into the plan that Minsky offers.
Thank
All right,
you.
Does that answer the question
thank
for
you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions at this point? Oh, that's right. We need to officially move the bill. Representative Detmer, would you do that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2322. Yeah. And for layover. Sorry.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We're going to hear from the university on why
that was my next move.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Could someone from the university care to address this bill?
And Mr. Chair, while they're coming down, I did make copies of Mr. Raby's email to me. I think that would be helpful for the members to have. Apologize for not giving it to you in advance, but if it's all right with you, I'd give it to the page to
sure.
redistribute it.
That'd be fine.
It's coming.
He's just coming down now. Okay. Got enough chairs? Okay. Go ahead,
Mr. Chairman.
Respond. Identify yourself first, please.
Yeah. My name is Ferdinand Schlopper. I'm the Director and Chief Health Officer of Boynton Health Services at the University of Minnesota. I've been in college health for 25 years at the University of Wisconsin, then at Boise State, and then joined the University of Minnesota in January. And I've also served on the American College Health Association Health Insurance Task Force. Working on these issues. A couple things I would like to say in response is that this is what the University of Minnesota has developed is actually one of the strongest programs in the country, in part because it is not imposed by the administration. It is a health insurance program for students developed by students. They are advisory to the development of the plan, and they set the level of benefit coverage, cost sharing levels, and the requirements to be part of the to best meet their needs, the healthcare needs on the campus. And so the students themselves have helped develop that the scope of the program and the requirements for coverage. What we have found is that there are, in trying to identify what other types of plans that students could waive out of, they don't have to have the university plan, they have the option to have alternative coverage with comparable benefit levels, is to determine what are those major categories of benefit levels that are most critical to meet the needs that address our student health concerns. And they are not having pre-existing condition exclusions, the level of prescription drug coverage, mental health coverage, and then the cost shifting. How much co-pays and deductibles is one area that a lot of students will look at for an alternative coverage. And the problem we have found with that is that over two-thirds of our student claims are for less than $500, three-quarters less than $1,000, and over 90% less than $5,000. So when you have high deductible plans, then they're really not providing that safety net of coverage for our students. So the students themselves said this is the limitations we want to have as far as the waiver options. We've communicated to students that certain types of plans will not, in most cases, meet those basic requirements. So we don't want students to go out and purchase a plan that, in fact, is not going to meet the requirements and then have to try and back out of that, like an association plan that we found doesn't meet those needs, like an individual insurance plan. But we do review on an individual basis, and on appeal in this case, too, did look at the review of that case to see if this happened to be one plan that did meet those basic requirements. and found, in fact, that it did not, that it had pre-existing condition exclusions, it had limitations, 50% on mental health benefits with no maximum for out-of-pocket payment, did not cover the differential between brand name and generic drugs. So there were key elements of this plan that did not meet those basic requirements for that the students themselves have determined are really required to best meet their needs. So we would not exclude any plan from consideration when appealed if it met those requirements. We're trying to let students know that in most of those cases, those plans will not meet that requirement.
Thank you. Do you want to add or just answer questions?
I'm Carl Anderson. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Boynton Health Service. The only thing I would add is that, as Mr. Schlapper described, we follow the American College Health Association standards for minimum benefit levels, and the most important thing isn't the type of product or insurance vendor as much as the level of benefits, and basically what we're doing is adhering to American College Health Association standards of coverage.
Okay, thank you. Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to anyone up there. It's very obvious to me that we have a non-traditional, might be going to the traditional program, but a non-traditional adult student, married kids, very capable, being responsible and making decisions relative to his health care on his own. I guess I'm having a hard time accepting that, given that he can make those decisions, why you would have such an objection. I know you have minimum standards. These are supposedly, decisions that made by, the student body regarding what they see as the needs. But I also believe quite heavily in choice and responsibility. And I guess what I'm not seeing here is any flexibility to allow for that. Here's a gentleman that's in your program. Must have been smart enough to get in your program. I'm sure it's pretty difficult to get in there. And he's made a choice that he thinks is responsible for his family. $3,500 a year is a lot of money. Comments?
Who would want to respond?
Mr.
Be happy to respond to that.
Is it, how do you pronounce your last name?
Mine?
Raby?
Raby.
Okay, Mr. Raby.
I certainly feel this is partially an issue of choice. But I disagree with their assessment that their insurance is superior. I mean, regardless of choice, I think the plan that I'm looking at makes every bit as much sense. The portability of it after school is right there is a big fact. $3,600 a year is important, but being able to take that insurance with you afterwards is all that much more important to me. I also disagree with their assessment about cost. For instance, the maximum deductible for their plan is on a per-person basis. The AVMAs is on a family basis. Right there could potentially be thousands of dollars a year difference. I think that's probably about all I want to say about it, but...
Mr. Slapper, do you have a... Someone else have a comment to respond?
I can say one more comment.
Representative Benson.
I remembered what I was trying to think of.
Mr.
Raby. You mentioned following the AMHA?
American College Health Association.
ACHA. And yet, the AVMA's insurance is accepted at 26 out of the 28 vet schools in the United States, or in North America, I'm sorry. I'm not quite, that seems a little bit, that doesn't add up to me. If you're following this requirement, what are these other 26 schools doing?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
My name is Sue Jackson. I'm the Director of Student Health Benefits at the university, and I was the administrator that worked with the Academic Health Center and implemented the insurance program that they have, that they requested, and also the waiver process and criteria. And I'd like to just address Mr. Robbie's comments about his plan being similar, and we've reviewed his plan, and the fact that the health care plan has a significant issue with coverage, the prescription benefit, and the mental health 50% coverage for in-hospital, out-of-hospital costs for mental health, and with no out-of-pocket limit. And a major portion of the claims that we see for students at the university is mental health. That's our biggest category. Now, what I'd like to do is back up and just state that When we implemented this policy at the request of the Academic Health Center, they said they wanted this program with this level of benefits, and we said in order to provide that, those level of benefits, that we needed to have an insurance requirement that was in place, that or a waiver process that would not only ensure that other students have similar and comparable coverage because they are at a greater risk of issues because of their medical area of study with needle sticks and a number of different things, but then also the fact that we need, of course, a certain not the level of benefits was first and foremost, and then by having a mandatory insurance requirement that we can apply evenly to all students was important so that we were applying in a non-discriminatory fashion. Association plans that we encounter in our business with all students really do not meet the standards that the Academic Health Center has asked for and requested for their students to provide a limitation to the risk that they experience when they're in school. And granted that while the cost is not that much different except for when you include a family plan. However, the benefits are definitely outweigh the benefits of the American Veterinary Association. So in order to continue to effectively provide the benefits that we do for the students in the Academic Health Center and effectively administer that waiver process, we have set the waiver level where it is, that it's students are required to participate in the AHC plan unless they're covered by an employer-sponsored group plan, because we hope that they'll have a similar level of benefits. Of course, now in these days, it's getting to be not the case. Or our graduate assistant health plan, which is very rich in benefits.
Because that raises the question, what would you do if the employer was not providing the adequate coverage, in your opinion?
Well, I think that, you know, we're at a point now 5 or 6 years into this program where we need to start reviewing that, because it is an issue. It is an issue for our students. You know, when we see the like I say, the mental health issues, the level of claims that our students are using, that, you know, at more than 50% of our students are impacted by these high deductible plans, and we see that because we see what the claims utilization is for our health plan overall. And we believe that, like I say, the Academic Health Center programs are, students in those programs have more risk based on their area of study and the clinical rotations that they do. We do see 30% of our students are diagnosed, have reported being diagnosed with mental health conditions. So mental health is really an area of concern as far as the level of benefits. And a significant difference when we have a no deductible plan. Our health plan has no deductible for our students and a $2,000 a year out-of-pocket maximum. And so it is very important that we sustain that plan also. For example, this morning I met with a medical school, and they're working on accreditation. And one of the key areas of their accreditation is that they have benefits, a good health plan and benefits available to their students. So this is all a part of that package. And to look at, you know, one student's concern and what this bill could do to not only the university's waiver process in this case and our ability to provide those exceptional benefits for students, but it will also have other impacts that we, you know, could get into a long discussion about today, but I know there's not time.
Anderson, do you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, another concern that is brought up to me just by this, you know, you could have a situation where a student who's attending the university happens to have coverage through their spouse who is not a student at the university, and then you're going to force the student then to get coverage if this is your ultimate plan, is to gradually make it so that even employer-provided health insurance would not be allowed under the university's guidelines. So I can see this just adding another financial cost to students at the university.
Representative Benson, did you have a follow-up question?
We've
got a number of people left.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I didn't hear was an answer to the question regarding, 26 out of 28, and if it rises to satisfying their needs, how is it that it doesn't the university's?
A couple things related to the choice question. That model is called the soft waiver instead of the hard waiver, where a student can opt out of the plan with any other type of coverage without certain criteria. And that has been that's a failed program at other universities, that they found that rather than trying to draw a distinction, what students could make that decision on their own, whether a returning adult student, whether they have family, all students eligible to choose what's best for them in their health insurance requirements, found that if there's a requirement for that, they're going to, in many cases, pick something with very limited coverage capability, has high out-of-pocket requirements, and really doesn't meet the core needs of what the student's insurance, just to have that low cost up front for the premium. And so that's where schools are looking at. We really have to establish some basic criteria in which this alternative plan meets these basic benefit requirements, which again, the students themselves determined in this plan. It's not imposed by the university. The students said to have a robust plan that meets our most pressing relevant health needs at the most cost-effective way possible, which is also one of the values of this plan, it being self-funded. So we took out the middleman for the insurance component, and it really is a self-funded plan that the benefits come back to the plan for the students, and holding down premiums and expanding benefit levels is the best possible option that the students determined themselves that they wanted.
Follow up. You should run for office. I didn't hear the answer, other than the rest of them don't know what they're doing. But you have 26 out of 28 that basically say that it's okay, but they take the soft road, and you've taken the high road.
They're establishing at their university, given their program, and perhaps with either their administration or their students, as to what level they're going to establish the requirements, which, again, you're looking at the unique needs for the University of Minnesota and the students on this campus and the demographics, saying this is what best meets our requirements.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Benson. You know, I'm trying to think this through. With my daughter being a college freshman, we had to make some of these decisions ourselves, and I have to say, I even wondered why they were telling us what type of coverage to have and at what levels, and I wasn't convinced it was the right decision that we were being asked to make, but I was able to at least justify to my mind by saying my daughter is living on campus, so therefore her health would certainly affect her roommate, the other people living in the dorms with her. So I say, okay, I can see where you might want to set some kind of requirement in terms of her health coverage, which doesn't seem to address Ms. Robbie's situation, if I understand it correctly. It seems to me there are at least three distinctions that should come into play here. One, an individual policy versus a family policy. My mother went back to school when she was in her 50s. I'm trying to figure out whether you would have required her to get her own insurance through the university. She's not living on campus, and neither is Mr. Robbie. I assume you're not living on campus either. So it seemed that some of those, you're living with your family, it seemed like the off-campus, on-campus distinction is important as we examine the rationale for why a university should be requiring the purchase of health insurance at all. There also seems to be an age question here. Certainly insurance coverage depends on age. The risks change over time. They get greater, they become decreased. But I'm not hearing that there's any age sensitivity in the policy that's being described here. So I understand the university's perspective in terms of wanting to make sure the student population as a whole is healthy or as healthy as possible. It does sound from your answers that you're also making financial decisions for Mr. Robbie that he may be very capable of making on his own. So I guess I would invite you, if the university does not want statutory language telling the university what to do, that we hear a better response on the difference between individual and family, on campus, off campus, and 18 to 22 to, excuse me, Mr. Robbie, older adults.
Someone want to respond to Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one point I was going to make is that...
Can I get your name again?
Carl Anderson, Chief Operating Officer. And I think those are great suggestions. And actually, I think in taking the plan a little farther, those are suggestions that we will incorporate. I think we're evolving on the undergraduate side, and I believe the Academic Health Center plan came first and will probably evolve more in favor of the undergraduate plan. But with respect to the choice and the financial risk, I'd say when we execute waiver requests, we do so without knowledge of the patient's medical history. So we don't know what risks the family or patient is willing to take if they have a mental health previous diagnosis or any other condition. We assume that we don't know the medical history, and therefore we do not, you know, we apply the waiver request kind of uniformly across all of the requestees.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about the undergraduate versus graduate, and I maybe didn't really understand who is expected to have this insurance, and is it just in vet school? Is it medical school? Is it dental school? Is it undergraduate students in liberal arts? Who all needs to meet this criteria?
All members of all students at the university who take 6 credits or more in a degree-seeking program are required to have health insurance and hospitalization insurance. So it's all students at the university with 6 credits or more in a degree-seeking program. The Academic Health Center program is an enhanced version of our undergraduate program. We've had soft waiver in effect for many years for the undergraduate program, and we're implementing a hard waiver next year for that program. And that's where we are applying criteria for benefit levels. So we'll waive individual plans, we'll waive dependent plans, we'll waive any association plan that meets our criteria. The biggest concern, as Mr. Schlopper described, were issues with the benefit levels, the pre-existing condition exclusions, the deductible limits, and some of the other core or essential benefit levels.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many waivers currently are you giving, and what would you anticipate you would when you switch over to that hard waiver in the future?
Ms. Jackson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Committee. I want to make sure we are, differentiating between the Academic Health Center and the overall university as a whole on the student plan. Right now with the Academic Health Center plan, which is the issue that Mr. Robbie is talking about, there's about 6,000 Academic Health Center students, and 4,000 of those students receive a waiver because they're on an employer-sponsored group plan or the graduate assistant planner or Minnesota Care. And we're anticipating, and the restrictive waiver that we're implementing in the fall is more, we've had an institutional requirement for health insurance as a condition of enrollment since the mid-70s, and because we know that the most common reason students drop out or the issues that they face financially are related to health issues. So this is what we're doing in the fall is more just asking students to verify their health coverage before they receive a 2-year waiver, just like we've been doing in the medical school, with some criteria, because we know that as we move into this time of health care reform that our plan costs less than the Blue Cross individual plan with a deductible of $2,000 or more, and our plan has no deductible. It has a guaranteed availability of application to a Blue Cross plan without going through underwriting after a student is no longer eligible for our plan. So this is one of the things that we've identified as issues for our students when they're done with their education at the university and find themselves without a job and maybe without insurance. And so we've got that in place. So we've got 2 issues here. The Academic Health Center waiver is a little more restrictive. The benefit design is very rich and better than my plan, sorry, and better than most employer-sponsored plans that exist today because it has no deductible and a $2,000 out-of-pocket max. So the issue is that these students in the AHC are at additional risk of exposure to illness and sickness because of what they're doing, and those criteria have been put in place 6 years ago, and we are in talks with the Academic Health Center on, when and what changes should be made, and, of course, taking into consideration Mr. Robbie's concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know there are others who have questions, but if I understood correctly, you said basically two-thirds of the students currently receive waivers.
Right, right. And we expect it to be similar for the university across the board.
All right. I think
Representative
I'll have...
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll have one additional question then, just regarding the on-campus benefits. Do students receive additional benefits if they're in that plan versus other plans on campus or with Boynton or whatever?
Well, Boynton, of course, the students pay student service fees, which is, you know, like they cover 40 different programs on campus. And part of that money comes to Boynton, and we use that money to provide a public health promotion items and then activities, and then subsidize the cost of providing health care for our students. So we do bill their insurance first, and then whatever their insurance, we receive their insurance payment as payment in full for most services. The big issues that take place, while we have a lot of comprehensive services at Boynton, students need referrals outside for additional diagnostic testing, procedures, or mental health services, and that's where we have issues all the time. I get anecdotes all the time from mental health that this person can't get treatment for their eating disorder because they have a high deductible plan and they can't afford it, or this person can't get a diagnostic test or procedure because they can't afford it. They're in a high deductible plan. In the case of the Academic Health Center students, we have, you know, the case of needle sticks and which automatically result in a $3,000 bill. And so if they use Boynton, that assists in those costs. But if they have to have services outside of Boynton, then that's the big issue and that's the concern.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions. First one regarding the university plan. The way I understand it's from being a freshman all the way through graduate school, correct? I know now parents can keep their students on their own plan till age 26. Now, when a student comes in and says, I have a parent plan, do you have to take a look at their plan and approve it?
Jackson? We would just take the proof of that enrollment in that parent's plan and apply it for a two-year waiver. So right now they self-report that information in the registration process, and we know that 10% of our students, 9 or 10% of our students are without health coverage. But the change this fall is just to ensure that they have the coverage that they're reporting, and then they will obtain a two-year waiver from enrollment in the health plan.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my second question, I know the Board of Regents really care a lot about conflict of interest. And isn't it in the university's financial interest to deny alternatives to and force students to pay for the university plan?
Actually not.
Ms. Jackson?
Because the health plan, the funding for the health plan is through student fees. That funding is kept in a totally separate account. It's not, that program is not subsidized by the general budget, but it's kept in a totally separate account just to be used for expenses related to the health plan. It is a self-funded plan, and it's kept separate.
Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is to Ms. Novak or maybe the university, so I'll try Ms. Novak first. How does this bill differ from other pieces of legislation where we can ask the U to do something and extra constitutionality comes up and they can politely look at us and go, that's nice of you to ask. So I know it says must, that's not my question. How does this bill differ?
Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pulaski, clearly it differs because it's not a request. As you've noted, there are other instances in Chapter 135A where there are directives dealing with health issues to both the governing boards of MNSCU and the University of Minnesota.
So Mr. Chair,
Mr. Chair, Ms. Novak, What's the penalty if the U doesn't do this?
Ms. Novak?
There is no particular penalty that is associated with this.
One
Representative Pulaski.
Other question, and this is to Ms. Novak. Could the policy of the university, as it was presented today, fit the bill that they are offering an alternative and they're in the process of offering it?
Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pulaski, their testimony here has indicated that they consider all types of coverage for the waiver process, but in fact rarely grant waivers for certain types of coverage. So it's not clear if it would, if their current practice would fit the intent of the bill.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair.
We have a comment.
Mr. Chair, just before the
okay, go ahead, Representative Pulaski.
It is interesting that in these situations, and we pass this bill, there really is no penalty, there's no lever on the university. That's just an observation, and I think that we've got Minsky included, too, in the bill, and apparently Minsky doesn't even do it, and we're doing it in the likelihood they might. So this seems a bill fraught with unintended consequences.
Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pulaski, as Ms. Novak pointed out, under the university, they do not allow for a waiver for the association group coverage, which if you'll see in the bill, that's the last item that's on line 1.12, which is what my constituent is referring to exactly. And I share your frustration in the fact that, you know, typically we do not have any recourse to go after the university to comply with these things that we pass. But I think as been highlighted here today, clearly there is a problem with the program that they have in the fact that we have an individual that has a family, that has done his homework, he has found a health insurance coverage that is fits his needs and his family's needs, and we want to make sure that he's able to go that route instead of having him have to purchase a coverage plan that is significantly more. As he gave in his testimony, $14,000 more. I don't know about you, but I would not be able to find an extra $14,000 in my pocket if I'm a student at the university and have three kids at home to feed. Now, if that is not motivation enough for the University of Minnesota to change their policies, I can't imagine what would be. But I am more than happy to work with you, Representative Pulaski, to give that carrot, to encourage the university to do this, because I know that this is important. I'm more than happy to work on language that would encourage them to make this change.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not arguing against your bill. I'm trying to understand if this bill would pass, what exactly it would do. And that's a different argument. So I would hope that perhaps before we get bills to this point, that there may have been that type of work done, so we would understand what other options there would be that we could, hopefully, the university would say these are options that are valid. So I'm not arguing against it. I'm sympathetic to what's happened here, but I also live in this world. And in this world, perhaps, it might be better that this would have been prepared a little more in advance.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pulaski. That's why I made my offer to you to work with you on suggestions that you might have in this realm of how we can encourage the university to make this change. I think one of my areas of frustration was I first received this request from Mr. Raby back in August, and I had contacted the university in September. I received no call back after leaving two voicemail messages. No call back. Because I was hoping to be able to resolve this outside of the legislature and that we wouldn't have to do legislation, that we wouldn't be sitting here today spending time of your precious time in committee going over this issue. So this is a little bit of a frustration that I've had, and I promised to Mr. Raby that I would work on this issue, and hopefully we can get this resolved.
Okay. Representative Rukavina, if there's anyone else who would like to testify, and we need to know that soon. So, Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I am guilty and gladly and admittedly guilty of for sticking up for my constituents too, and I would have done the same thing that you do. In fact, I got a couple bills right now in the legislature here introduced that deal with individuals' problems because they ran into bureaucracy that wouldn't address it. It is a shame that Representative Blau said this bill had to come here, because you think, you know, with all the bright minds at the university, some kind of common sense could have prevailed. But, you know, as far as can we force the university, there is the constitutional separation question, but it's like the, you know, it's like the stadium, the Gopher Stadium. When they got their separation of state and university, they didn't get a liquor license with it. So we could tell them that they had to serve booze to everybody or nobody at the U. And there are laws dealing generically with health insurance that they have to meet too. As far as, correct me if I'm wrong, Council, but I know with my flag bill, and I hate putting penalties in law, that there is always a misdemeanor if it's not addressed in law. So I would think that the university, if they don't obey this law, would be guilty of a misdemeanor. And every time they violated it, they'd have to pay up to, who are the lawyers? We're all left. Okay. Well, maybe a lawyer in the audience. I think it's about $1,000 each time for a misdemeanor. So I would,
for you.
Well, no, mine are much higher. Anyway, I go all the way up to felony. But, no, I commend you for doing this, because you're right. I've tried times, too, to call up and say, hey, can't we do this without having to do a bill? And nobody wants to budge. So,
is there anyone else who would like to, in the audience, who would like to make a comment? If you can make it very brief, please. We have another bill before us soon. Please identify yourself.
Yes,
please.
My name is Kim Reckinger.
Okay.
I have a son at the University of Minnesota, and we've been dealing with this issue since last November. My son transferred from Drake University, was accepted at the U. Our health coverage was accepted at that time. And then we got a bill for the first semester's $950 for their insurance plan because ours was rejected. Technically, we do not have insurance. We are, according to the federal definition, we have a traditional indemnity plan. Indemnity plan this is the research we did, by the way, on definitions of health care in Minnesota, definitions of health care at the federal level. By the way, our health care has been accepted under the federal, the new Obamacare, for a better name of it, has been accepted under that plan. A traditional indemnity plan basically says that the person or the group is reimbursed for their medical expenses. And so that's what we have. We are in not technically an association, but it basically is an association. And then we also have a private, by the way, my son lives at home, goes to the U. We also have a private, a doctor-owned clinic. So we have medical coverage under the association plan, and we have clinical coverage under the other plan that we have purchased, which is far less than, and it's a family plan. Also, these standards, it was mentioned that the standards from the ACHA, we went out to their website, unless I have something different than, not as detailed, but there are 10 standards. They are very general. It does not give specifics on coverage, as far as I know, as far as what they put on their website. Also, just to give you an idea, out of the 11 Big Ten schools, 6 of them require no coverage. It's up to the individual student, or if they need medical help, they go to their own university hospitals and clinics, which must be covered under some kind of student fee. Out of the other 5, and by the way, the University of Minnesota, as you may know, has one of the highest tuition rates in the Big Ten. Out of the 5 other ones, Minnesota has the most restrictive mandates available under the new mandates that are being required. So six of those Big Ten schools, Wisconsin, Illinois, Penn State, Indiana, Michigan, all of those do not require medical care. It's up to the individual's responsibility, or they are covered, like I said. We have met with the U since last November. We've been dealing with this issue. We've gone to as many sources as we can, and I have another son that's graduating. We have applied at the U, and when this came up, we stopped. We stopped the application because this will cost us another up to $2,000 a year if we cannot resolve this situation. So either I have to come, and that's why we stopped his. That would have been an extra $4,000 a year that we would have had to come up with.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Otherwise, any comments, final comments from Representative Anderson?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chair, to you and to the members for hearing this plight for these individuals. Health insurance costs for everyone is very high, and I'd like to be able to relieve this burden. These folks have done their homework. They have found alternative forms of health insurance, and I think that they should be allowed that option to choose the coverage that fits their family the most. So I'll leave it at that, and thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Anderson. And if those of you that came in late didn't get a cookie, they were courtesy of Representative Anderson. They're sitting over there with Rukavina. They're not your cookies.
I didn't know. I was afraid to touch them.
Okay. Then we move House File 2322 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. All right. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2065 and for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Chair Nordis. Would you go ahead and address your bill?
Anyone didn't get a cookie? We have a whole bunch in here. Did you get one? Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2065 is a request from MNSCU, which would increase the current revenue bond authority from $300 million to $430 million. And in the interest of time, I think I'd like to have Laura King from MNSCU then proceed to talk about this request and the need for it.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. King. Would you introduce yourself?
Certainly. Thank you. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor for Finance for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the time before you this afternoon. The Board of Trustees is seeking legislative approval to increase the system's revenue bond authority in order to continue progress on our multi-year master facilities plan for our colleges and universities. The revenue fund is a creature created in statute in 1955 to provide revenue bond financing capacity for auxiliary facilities at our state universities. Over the years, revenue bonds have been used to build and repair residence halls, dormitories, student unions, and parking ramps. Shortly after the 1995 merger, we paid off the remaining debt and began bringing auxiliary facilities plans into our overall master facilities planning process, including academic buildings, athletic facilities, and the whole campus planning. In 2008, the two-year colleges, at their request and with the support of the two-year student association, were added to the fund's activities. The fund presently has $265 million in outstanding debt, with a weighted average remaining maturity of 17 years and an average annual debt service cost for the current debt representing 20% of the program's annual revenues. The bonds are retired through special purpose charges related to the facility. For instance, bonds for dorms are retired with dorm charges, bonds for student unions are retired with student activity fees, bonds for parking ramps are retired with parking charges. So they're essentially user charges paid for by the users of the facilities. We've been working with the colleges and universities to develop a 3 to 5 year improvement plan for each of the campuses. These plans have brought us to you today with a request for additional borrowing capacity. No project will proceed without much more board review and much more student consultation. We're seeking the action in order to keep the review and consultation process moving forward. Current planning outlook includes $149 million for university projects and $25 million for college projects over the next 4 years. All of the above projects required by our board policy to obtain strong letters from student consultation before they proceed to the board for review and approval. The board subjects each project to a very intense financial review, a market review, a cost review to understand the cost to the students, none of these projects will proceed to the board for ultimate sale without all of those activities happening. The bill would enable us to increase the authority for the colleges and the universities in order to keep the planning process going. We would be reluctant to continue working on these projects if we didn't understand that we had the capacity to take the projects to completion prior to spending any more money on them. Now, we understand that the student associations are going to testify today, and we know there's been some conversation with the student associations. We certainly anticipate more discussion before the bill is settled, but we are particularly interested in making sure members understand that we have university projects and college projects in both 13 and 15 planned. The university projects amount to $405 million, and then the college projects are what takes us to $430 million. We hope members are able to support the bill today, and we look forward to any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. King?
Point out in the packets there's some information dealing with the current reserves that some of the campuses have. Are you aware of that document? And I guess the question would be, in some cases, will some of that money be used also to pay down the reserve if they have a larger amount than...
Ms. King?
You have a policy, I assume, as to how much that reserve should be per campus?
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Nornes, the board has a policy expecting reserves in the 5 to 7% range, and it's absolutely the case that some of the funds that you see on the material in your packet may very well be used as part of these projects. It's too early for me to say because we're in very early days from a finance plan standpoint, but it is the practice when possible for colleges and universities to try to save some cash to avoid debt costs. We know that's happening. We have in front of our board in just a couple of days a request from Southeast Technical Community and Technical College to use cash to build a building, and they got the cash from a land sale. So sometimes you'll see funds sitting in these accounts that came through sales. They might be coming because they're building up cash for a capital improvement project. In the most recent program, the Anoka Ramsey Student Center included cash from the college along with bonds, which enabled them to lower their debt costs and gave them a chance to take a couple of years of planning to get ready for the financing. So I would expect, as we move these projects forward, that we will see some cash coming from the schools. The board is very aware of the financial condition of all of the colleges and universities and has standards for that financial condition. We have, by our accrediting agencies, an expectation that we have cash on hand and that we just keep it on hand. We don't collect it and then spend it. We need cash for cash flow purposes. We get tuition twice a year, and we have payroll expenses 12 times or 26 times a year. So we have needs for cash just as a course of business. But yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Nornes, I would expect that we will use some of the cash for these projects.
And Representative Plowski, you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, a couple of them. This is to Chair Nornes. If this is included in the supplemental bill, is it then a supplemental fiscal bill? That's my first question.
Representative Nornes?
I believe you're probably right.
All right. And this is for the chair, Representative Norris. This is for the record. We now have a supplemental fiscal bill that we're putting together.
Just to clarify, Norris. This is not appropriation. This is just authorization.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, this is an increase in authority of bonding that has an impact on student fees and has an impact on a number of other fiscal issues. I'm just wondering what the threshold is to get to a fiscal bill. I'm confused and need to be clarified here.
I'm not trying very hard, but you know, before we're done, I can't guarantee where we'll be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, I might be a little more conservative to you, but if I'm spending or authorizing the spending of money, I characterize it as fiscal, but that's just my innate conservatism showing through. Mr. Chair, I have another question. This is for Ms. King. Have we had a presentation from Minsky on where the level of this revenue bonding and exact, you've sort of in a cursory way articulated there are some things that have to be done. And I can understand we've got aging facilities, we've got aging dorms, we have some other things that need to be repaired. Do we have a breakdown by campus of what you're intending to do? For instance, are you planning on bringing certain dormitories completely offline and tearing them down? And then are you planning on replacing them? Are you doing something with the student centers that's upgrading them to the 21st century so that they would be more receptive for technology? Do we have a presentation like that? Or do you have something that you could visit with us with so we know where this money is going to go?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, we have master plans for every single campus, and they include plans about the dormitories. In some instances, like at Bemidji, we remodeled. At Mankato, we're getting ready to demolish. At Winona, we built new and remodeled. So we have worked our way through each campus, and we'd be happy to visit with you. We do have plans.
Representative Pawlowski.
One other thing. When you said Southeast Tech, are you referring to the Southeast Tech that's in Winona and Red Wing? Is that the land sale? Is that what you're referring to?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, President Pawlowski, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pawlowski. King, you said land sale. That wasn't a land sale and a building sale.
It was a building sale. The ICE arena, or the airport facility.
Representative Pawlowski.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Ms. King, there's a significant difference between a land sale and a building sale, particularly when that building is at the age it is, and this raises another issue for me. Old buildings, out-of-date buildings, buildings that we can no longer repair and use, I can understand why we need to repair them. When we're looking at something like this, and we're looking at a facility that was built relatively recently, given other structures on many campuses, then we're selling the facility. This goes back to my theme in the first weeks of session. Are we addressing the fact that we may have a decline in student enrollment? And that decline in student enrollment, are you building for continually having more students? Are you beginning to take a look at what might happen when we have significantly less students on these campuses? Is that part of what we're going to see in your presentation?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, President Pawlowski, over the last 10 years, we have spent probably 95% of the funds the state has provided to us on remodeling of existing facilities. We've had about 1 million square feet of new space on a base of about 26 million. The board's number one capital investment priority since merger has been asset preservation and renewal. So we've been very, very aggressive to repurpose our existing facilities. There are occasions when we need to build new, like the Winona Science Building, where there just wasn't a solution on campus inside the existing footprint. But we're very mindful of space utilization. And we've had several requests in the bonding bills over the years for funds to demolish that in the end weren't supported.
It's not exactly an answer, Ms. King. We're talking about revenue bonds here. And you mentioned the sale of a structure at a particular campus. I can understand when there is a need to replace a number of buildings. But my overall question is, are you looking far enough into the future when this need to continually build new, or let's say you take a dormitory down, is there an absolute need to replace that dormitory? I can understand at the campus level where you might want to do that, but is there a need to do that? And my other point is this. We're now at the stage where we're selling relatively new structures because there is not the program to fill it or the students to fill it. Mm-hmm. That's a different, to use an expression often battered around in this building, paradigm. And those paradigms are pretty expensive to build, and when we have to sell them, that, to me, shows a direction that Minskew better take a very hard look at before we are embarking on anything more of an expansion. We better take a hard look at what we're doing with what we have, how we're going to preserve it, and I'm all for asset preservation. But I still haven't seen from Minskew a detailed look at what we're going to do with these revenue bonds.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pawlowski, we do take dorms down and not replace them, or we mothball them. We've mothballed dorms at Moorhead. We've mothballed them at Bemidji. We are working very, very thoughtfully about what is the long-term demand for dorms, and we're shrinking the stock across the system. On the subject of the airport facility in Southeast Tech's case, I agree with you. We don't like to be in a position where we have a building that we don't need. In this instance, it's remote from the campus. It was built special purpose for an industry that has shifted in ways I don't think anybody expected. We're being very thoughtful about new buildings and about acquiring buildings. And I think when we have a chance to sit down together, you'll see that.
Representative Morrow, you have a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's actually going to be two comments. And Representative Nornes, I would also be turning to Representative Vanney. Now, the first thing that concerns me here is the use of revenue bonds generally, being that they're more expensive than either general obligation or appropriation bonds in terms of the coverage that's needed. So I'm concerned about not only revenue bonds generally, but turning to my second comment, the expanded use of revenue bonds here. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, did you want to? I thought you were.
Thank you. I was just saying, if you had a cell phone on, or we might have to turn it off here. Now it stops. So, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Norris, here's my concern. We're now going to expand the ability of Minskew to use revenue bonds, and part of me wants to defer to Minskew to make the decision, and I understand the student role in this. But to me, this feels like when I was a school board chair and I was told I can go back to my voters and ask for property tax money in order to pay for school buildings. In part because my voters were left with no choice because the state wasn't going to adequately fund K-12 education. So I feel like the students here, in some ways, are being put into a very bad position. You can agree to this, but if you don't agree to pay either higher dorm fees or higher parking fees in order to produce the revenue for these revenue bonds, you're going to be in an older dorm, an inadequate dorm, inadequate parking, what have you. So I worry a little bit about saying to Minskew, go ahead and expand your use of revenue bonds, because ultimately the students are going to be paying for these revenue bonds, in at least in part. And it has two negative effects. One is it's another increase of cost to students beyond the tuition increase. They now have all these fees they get to pay more, so they can cover part of these revenue bonds. And number two, it seems to take the pressure off of us to actually fund higher education at the level it needs to be funded at if we simply say, Minskew, you can do revenue bonds and go back to your users to pay them. So I have concerns about this approach. Not absolutely opposed, but I'm very concerned about what position this puts students in.
Representative,
was that a question?
No.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, this is not a new idea, the whole idea of this approach. I did visit with a president from Morehead last weekend who told me that the dormitory that they have on their campus will not get the updates that it needs unless this increase is provided by the legislature. So I see both sides, but I see that we really ought to move on and grant this authority. That's my opinion.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Question. Chair. How is the amount determined to go to $430 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, we have worked with the campuses systematically to do master planning. And as that planning proceeded, we had projects in the academic domain, to Representative Morrow's question, that were moved into the GO column as part of the GO capital program. And we had projects that for the last 60 years have been funded as a revenue fund project. and those projects then moved into the revenue fund column. The list is the result of that master planning, with campuses thinking out 5 to 10 years about what kinds of facilities requirements do they face, thinking about the financial impact on students and which projects could be brought forward from that context. So the list is the result of the campus planning process in concert with our multi-year guidelines for master facilities management.
45 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Poppy.
And Ms. King. In the strategic plan, is there a plan to increase it again in the future as you're looking at 5 years, 10 years, whatever?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, this request will take us out into the mid-decade, and then the planning process, informed in part by Representative Pawlowski's observation about enrollment, will develop another look at what the campuses need. We're about done with dorms across the universities, and I haven't seen a request for housing at the college level yet that made any sense, so I don't expect to see them as part of this program. There's likely to be some more parking ramps, particularly in the metro area, and I think there's one or two university student unions that need to be refreshed. Most of the student union infrastructure, of course, is 50 years old, and so it comes a time when it needs to be refreshed. So we'll have another planning cycle and take another look at it. As a matter of financial management, we have targets for the overall debt burden we want on the system and on the students, and that's part of our consideration.
Okay, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would, the term mothball has been talked about, and I'm just wondering, this maybe goes to Representative Nornes, actually. It seems as though we've just scratched the surface on understanding some of these things, and maybe there's an opportunity for us to have a more in-depth discussion and awareness education about the mothballing concept, the need for increasing this the maximum amount to do some other things. I'm not sure if we've actually done as much in-depth as might make sense to do. So just as a comment on that. And then the other thing is, as the colleges, the universities make some plans for this, how actually is that overseen by MNSCU as a central office system?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, the master planning is done per guidelines that we generate and our board approves. The capital project itself is administered like we administer any capital project, with policies and practices on contracts and bidding and award. We delegate the project to the campus to execute. So once the architect and the constructor are selected, then the campus runs the construction project and the system office steps out of it. But we administer them the same way, whether it's a GO dollar or a revenue fund dollar or a campus cash dollar for that matter. Same standards, same legal constraints. It's all the same in that respect.
Okay, we have one more question, and we want to move on to our student testifiers. Representative Plosky.
Ms. King, can you explain how revenue bonds are paid off? Let's say Winona State builds 3 new dormitories right along the railroad tracks. Is it just the Winona State campus that pays off those new dormitories, or is that spread throughout the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, we don't have any cross-subsidy in the revenue fund. If it's earned on the Winona campus, it stays on the Winona campus. So they charge a dorm fee for their dorms, and that dorm fee is used to pay off the bonds that were sold for that dorm. There's no money does not flow upriver.
Mr. Chair, Ms. King, when you build a student center, dorms, or whatever it is, then there is no increase across the entire campus system for students who are using dormitories or student centers, whether it's built at Winona or Bemidji or St. Cloud?
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, I'm not sure I follow your question, but the bonds are attached to a particular project, and the project generates the income to pay off the bonds.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to be clear that when you build these things, then it is not shared by all students living in all dorms when you are building dorms, and it is reflected then in the fee a student pays, regardless of where they are in the MNSCU system, for the building of those new dorms.
Ms. King?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, I think maybe an example would be the easiest way to, for me to be sure I'm answering your question. There were just several new dorms opened at Winona that were built out of the 2011 sale. The students living in those dorms pay a room and board charge, and that's all we use to pay off the bonds for that dorm. There's no money coming from other campuses. There's no money coming from the system office. It's retired by the charges to the students living in the building.
So, Pawlowski?
Mr. Chair, Ms. King, I think we need to have a private sit-down on this one. I want a little more clarity on exactly how this is paid off, both at the campus and state level. And if we could do that, I would appreciate it. I don't disagree with you, but I think we... I just want more information.
Be happy to.
All right.
Thank you, Ms. King. And we have two student testifiers. If they would both come up at this time.
Thank you, members. Take an Oreo and see how.
Take two. And we have Amanda Bardorner and Jeff Detbrenner. And would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Amanda Bardorner, State Chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'm here today in support of MinSCU's request for an increase in the Revenue Fund Bonding Authority. After a lot of consideration with our board, which is made up of the student body presidents from the seven state universities, our board thought it was in favor to support this increase for the fact that our students would then be able to continue consultation conversations that they're having on campuses as far as long-term planning with not only their residence halls, but also with their student unions and parking needs on their campuses. With this, it allows, as you've heard, for that two-year bonding cycle. Our association is particularly interested in that because it allows us to really engage in conversations with MinSCU and really set that number and manage that money collectively as it is the student dollars which are increasing to pay for the projects. I wanted to address Representative Morrow's statement about students needing to pay for if they want the nicer facilities. That certainly is the case when you're talking about res halls and you're talking about student unions. But I did want to offer an example where students have not been in favor of a project, even though we thought overwhelmingly that they would be. I'm a student at St. Cloud, like I said, and our student union was built in, it's actually had five different phases of construction, but the most recent was in, I believe, the 60s. And now it has gone to a student vote of the 18,000 students at St. Cloud State, and it has failed twice. And so now you'll see in the list of projects that there's a $5 million number for St. Cloud. It's because we need to do some R&R that there aren't funds for, and so there's a minimal increase that the students will see, but it's to keep the building functional. Otherwise, they wouldn't have that. And so it certainly allows for that consultation to happen among students. If the students aren't in support, the project doesn't go forward. I know there are other examples that we've seen where that has certainly happened. Another part is that we have to remain competitive. I know that when I was looking at campuses, I strictly focused on the private colleges because the aesthetics are amazing. That, as a student, that's what's sexy, that's what's the wow factor of a campus. And we don't necessarily have that always at the MinSCU universities because it is up to the students in some particular instances. So our residence halls and things like this, we need to continue to upgrade and remain competitive and seek and attract those students that we need for our enrollment numbers to continue to increase and to not see those decreases that might be projected. I guess at this time I'd keep my comments minimum, but I would yield to Jeff Dipper.
Welcome. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. For the record, my name is Jeff Dipperner, president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, representing our public two-year community and technical colleges. I'm speaking to you today in support of an increase in the MinSCU System's Revenue Fund Authority at a level that would allow just the four-year university projects to be funded through a fiscal year 2015 bond sale. As for future projects at our two-year colleges, our association does not support additional authority. New revenue fund projects levy significant fees on students, so it's essential that we are as informed as possible about the project's scope, fee structure, and other alternatives. Our students would like to work with the Minsky leadership over the next biennium to strengthen the development process and scope of future revenue fund projects at our two-year colleges. Thank you, and I will yield for any questions.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, Representative Narnes. And you know, I labored with this issue when I was the chair of this committee, because we all know what's happening with tuition increases and with cuts that I had to, you know, face starting in 2008. But how much debt are we going to put on the students? You know, in the past, years ago, and not that long ago, we used to pay for the state all the bonding projects requests, and then we went to half and half. And, you know, now in light of what Ms. King told Representative Pawlowski, because we were kind of debating amongst ourselves here how it was applied across the whole system or not, it makes me nervous if, like a rainy river that has, I don't know, Jeff, helped me out, 300 and some students, has to do a revenue bond. You know, when you got 365 kids to pay for a $2 million, their portion of a $6 million dormitory, which I was called about. So I'm afraid that the next major financial crisis in this country isn't going to be housing. It's going to be student debt when it comes crashing down on everybody. And I'm just nervous. So look at these numbers, committee members. You know, we've tripled in a decade. And now we're asking for a 40% increase in 2 years. I mean, how far do we go? How much debt do you want to put on your members? It's troubling to me, and it all gets back to, I think, I guess, for lack of a better word, how cheap we've been at the Capitol here in the last decade about funding, particularly education in general, but higher education has taken the brunt of all the hits around this place for a decade.
Any other questions? Chair Norris, do you want to renew?
I would like to again renew House File 2065. We recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in our higher education omnibus bill.
Okay, House File will be laid over.
Thank you. All right, thank you for a good discussion on that last bill. Now we'd like to, we seem to be talking a lot about the university today. And we're glad to have President Kaler with us today to kind of respond to, I guess, an article in the paper and to clarify where the university is on the issue and moving forward, I guess, is what we're looking for. So, President Kaler, welcome to the committee.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to come before you. I know you have questions for me, but with the chair's permission, I'd like to offer some opening comments. You've asked me to discuss separation and transition packages for senior leaders at the university over the past 3 years. I regret that those past decisions may have hurt the public's trust in our stewardship of this great university. And while these agreements were set before my arrival, I am the president of the University of Minnesota, and I take responsibility for where we are. I am not in a position to fully explain my predecessor's decision, but I will say that he did act within our policy, which gives the president discretion. There were also many of these agreements, which is normal at the end of a presidential term and a transition. However, I, like you, view these packages as very generous. My approach will be different. I'm committed to transparency, accountability, and the public trust will guide every action that I take. Let me briefly describe our compensation policies and how I will make those decisions, and then I will hear your concerns, of course. Our compensation packages reflect the market and the practice in higher education across the country and in institutions with which we compete for talent. We are in a highly competitive global market for top talent, and we must be competitive. Our policy allows administrators returning to the faculty to take a transitional leave at their faculty pay level, which is generally lower than their administrative salary. The policy is clear that if someone does not return to the university after their sabbatical, the transitional salary must be repaid. I intend to stick to those guidelines. However, anyone who has managed people knows that personnel matters can be complex and managers often need some discretion. Nonetheless, I will ensure that substantial deviations from this policy are reviewed with the leadership of the Board of Regents, and I will be proposing a policy change at the university to accommodate that. Let me address two additional issues. First, Joel Maturi's pay after he steps down as athletic director. While his pay has been the subject of scrutiny and some controversy, it is not the case of a transitional leave or a retirement. In fact, Joel is staying on as a regular professional employee. He'll be teaching courses in sports management and doing important fundraising for athletics. His base salary reflects the market, but let me be clear, he will earn every cent, I expect, many times over in fundraising. Second, let me say a word about my own contract. It's been public since I was named to this role about 16 months ago. My contract does provide a year transitional leave at the presidential salary before returning to the faculty. That is my intent, but if for some reason I do not return to the university, I will pay that money back. Overall, I believe my approach to compensation is principled and fair. My approach is to pay for performance, to align the universities and the public interest, and to advance the university's mission. I compensate leaders to act in the best long-term interest of the organization, and I work to attract, motivate, and retain top talent in a highly competitive environment, and ensure that compensation reflects the realistic and practical market alternatives for our senior leaders. I will promote more transparency and accountability in setting compensation, and I've begun conversations with my senior leadership team and with the board to achieve this. So in closing, let me be clear. I share your commitment to maintaining the public trust, and it's absolutely critical to the future health and vitality of this great institution. Those are my comments, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, President Kaler. I think it's important to hear from you and to kind of chart a course going forward, and I think that's what we wanted to do today. I don't know if members have anything further to comment on or question Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, this is just to you again. Would we have the opportunity for the Chancellor to come up and have his observations on the bonuses that were given over the last few years in the Minsky system? Would that be an appropriate presentation to this committee, too? There were actually amendments in this committee offered. There were amendments on the floor that ultimately were incorporated into the higher ed bill that addressed what was going on in the Minsky system. And now that we have a new chancellor, wouldn't it be appropriate for perhaps that chancellor to come forward and give us his interpretation of how these bonuses are going to be done?
Representative Pawlowski, we can sure take that under consideration, and good suggestion.
For possible inclusion in the fiscal bill? Or
all right. We'll have to talk privately about that. But have a cookie.
Give him back. Oh. No, you'll just wire him up more.
Members, any questions? Oh, Representative Benson, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I apologize that you only have 4 minutes. I think that's the biggest problem that we have is that we've kind of exhausted our opportunity. But I have many.
Representative Benson, we have till 2:15.
15. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Thank you. I guess my question is, and maybe this will lead to many more, as I look at the very first person, and I respect the president, the prior president, President Brunig's immensely. But I guess I'm curious, for $341,000 a year as a faculty member, what's his faculty load going to look like? I think we owe it to the public to have some questions around what should we expect from a faculty member making $341,000 a year?
Which
President Kaler?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. To whom are you referring?
This is Brunix. Yeah, I mean, I have on the sheet before me that President Brunix will rejoin the faculty at age 70, earning $341,000 a year, and I just you know, what's his load look like? I mean, what is that going to entail?
So,
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, he will be engaged in scholarship in his area of interest at the Humphrey Institute. He will be teaching. He will be writing. He will be an active member of our faculty and developing leadership in the area of his expertise. He is a senior member, obviously, of our faculty, enormously respected around the country as a leader in higher education. He's played leadership roles at several national organizations. He brings great luster to our faculty, so I'm comfortable with his workload and with the impact he will have both on the students he teaches and in representing the developing the reputation of the university outside of the Twin Cities.
Representative Benson,
thank you. Yes, and thank you. Do you think that though that there'll be any questions from the average person on the street regarding, you know, what you just told me? I teach at a very small college. My assumption is that there'll still be some questions on the street that we're bringing a person back at $350,000 a year thereabouts, and some accountability regarding his output.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I understand clearly that the salaries paid to senior faculty, senior leaders who may return to the faculty, are big numbers in the eyes of the people of Minnesota. I get that. However, we are in a marketplace in higher education in which senior leaders are paid at the level or, frankly, above what senior leaders are paid at the University of Minnesota. And after a lifetime of service at that level, to have the opportunity to return to the faculty at that salary is not inconsistent with practices of most higher education institutions around the country.
No further. Representative Puffy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there money specifically budgeted for these actions that occurred?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppe, we do maintain a flexibility in our budget that can allow for these kind of transitions. I don't believe that we keep a particular fund, but I could ask our Chief Financial Officer to come to the table to give you a more clear accounting of that line or provide that to you separately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Poppe.
Actually, I could probably get that individually, but it's been noted that President Brunix gave $2.8 million in this last year. Do you know what the amount would have been in each of the last 5 years or 10 years or over the course of his tenure as president? Maybe that would be helpful to kind of get an idea about an average or about what actually has happened throughout the course of that time.
Certainly, Mr.
Chair. I assume you may have to go back and figure that out.
Okay, but I can tell you that the bolus of these transitions did occur near the end of President Brunig's term. He had a quite remarkably stable group of higher of senior leaders during his term and followed by this amount of turnover, but we certainly can get you that schedule.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, another follow-up. You have talked about that there will be outcomes and you will be overseeing some of those outcomes. Can you just describe a little bit about the process and how that's going to differ, perhaps, and what was what I understood, some people received the money, but they didn't actually have to do or show any performance, and how that's going to be different under your tenure?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobby. I am committed to having faculty who we pay a salary perform. It's remarkable that I have to say that, but it's true. So when faculty take these transition leaves from administration to go back to the faculty, there is an expectation. So Frank Zara, who's returning to the faculty from the Senior Vice President for Academic Health, has a work product to deliver a history of the AHC. Chuck Muscoplatt has a work product to deliver around development of pharmaceuticals. President Brunix has writing ambitions, and will be doing that, although, of course, his recent time scheduled to be at the Bush Foundation will impact the schedule on which he delivers. So that is my expectation. I will ask to see those work products, and I expect them to be produced.
Thank you, and I believe one final question I have. You talked about paying back if there isn't a product done. If you don't give it out in the first place, you wouldn't have to worry about getting it paid back. There was some instances where the university gave the final payment out to people who weren't intending to return to the university, and actually one of them is Chancellor Rosenstone, who received some money but does not have an expectation that he's returning to the U. He's transitioned over to be the chancellor at Minsku. So how will that differ under your tenure?
President Gaylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, I believe that, and again, I am in the unfortunate position of interpreting President Brunig's intentions in this particular arena. I imagine that he viewed providing a transition for Chancellor Rosenstone as in the best overall interest of higher education for the state of Minnesota, and frankly, it probably was to allow him to move into the chancellorship with a higher velocity at the beginning. Having said that, I believe I would have asked my colleagues at Minsku to pay that salary.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm just I'm not even sure I'm middle class anymore. It's always hard to tell. Schmuck that makes $30,000 a year. So are my constituents for the most part. And this is to the constituency that I represent appalling. You acknowledged that you understood that. I guess I do hope that you do. As a legislator, I sit here and lament cuts for, sorry, I can't see you, cuts for $1 million or $2 million over the last few years. I mean, we have agonized over cuts to the U of $1 million or $2 million since I have been here. And then last year, of course, more. And so to sit here at this table and have that agony and that discomfort about cutting quality education for our students and the university that at least I and I think most of us here highly value, a great research university in this country, to make those kind of cuts and see where that money is going is frankly shocking. And so I guess I didn't want to just leave this room. You said the right thing, and you said you're going to review these policies, and I encourage you to review them, because what I see are settlements, and you call them transitions, whatever you want to call them, more generous than the private sector, more generous than what I see in my community, even at Mayo Clinic. This is public tax dollars in a public institution, and I'm not blaming you, and I'm sorry, but I just feel like I want to say this, I want you to hear it, not just come out of your mouth, because you said the right thing, but from my mouth on behalf of my constituents, that we really want you and the Regents to go back and review your policies and make some significant changes so that when we sit here and cut millions of dollars, we've hit the students twice. We've hit them with that cut, and we've hit them with this cut. And that isn't where I want my tax dollars and my constituents' tax dollars to go. I want it to go to support the teachers, to support the students, to lower their tuition, and get more kids in college. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I hear you very clearly. And, I don't know what else I can tell you besides that. I do invite people to watch what I do, because I can control what I do.
President Kaler, I really want to thank you for being here today, and I think moving forward, I think we'll this is over and done. We can't change that. But again, I do appreciate you being here and expressing your opinions on how things will look moving forward. And I guess we have one further inquiry from President.
Soon to be. It's another
Representative Pawlowski.
Mr. Chair, when we dealt with the issue on the Minsku side in this committee by amendment, it failed. When those same amendments were offered on the House floor to the Higher Education Finance Bill, One passed overwhelmingly by roll call vote, the other by voice vote. So I am serious when I say we should look at both, Mr. Chair, because they are equally egregious. But I'm also serious in this. I think higher ed, both the U and Minskew here, reflect an economic past that brought this country down. This is what happened on Wall Street with the banking, with real estate, and with the automotive industry. Exactly this type of thing. And disrespect for the economic system and greed on a colossal scale. And Mr. Chair, I'll make one other observation. I hope it does not do injury to higher ed also. So, Mr. Chair, when we offer bills and amendments, I would hope you would at least be fair this session, and we get to hear from both.
I disagree when you use the words greed and some of those. I don't agree with you on that, but I think policy-wise there are some things that are going to change, and I guess I agree with that.
Well, Mr. Chair, that is my point, that we have a new president at the U. He has come forward. He is stating he's changing the policy. I have not heard from the new chancellor whether or not those policies will be changed. I would like to hear that.
We will see if we can oblige. And right now, members, we are adjourned.